Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, General.
Thank you.
It is about 7 minutes after one. In attendance of the House Judiciary Committee are Rep. Gruenberg, Representative Lynn, Representative Coghill, myself, Representative Ramirez, Representative Samuels. Our friend Representative Holmes is away in D.C., but she sat in, I believe, on the Senate Judiciary Confirmation Hearing. And Rep. Dahlstrom has an ear infection. She's been nursing for a while, and she is pursuing treatment. We had a request earlier in the day by Representative Olson to join us and to participate in a few questions. So at the discretion of the chair, if and when he arrives, I'll invite him up to participate in some questions. We would be delighted if we got through our questioning today. However, this committee is in no special hurry. We're more interested in hearing from you because we have a lot of questions, and we don't feel a need to hurry this process. We're thrilled to have you. Representative Olson, we just were on the record saying that you were going to come join us. You're welcome to come sit up here. Representative Holmes is away, so there's no danger that she will take your seat. We're happy to have you. I indicated to the Attorney General that you may be inquiring about the state's general liability policy regarding streets, walkways, hydrants.
A lot of slip and fall questions.
Yes, a lot of slip and fall issues. And so with that, you're welcome here. We have I will preface with these remarks. In my dealings with you since we've come here, I have found you to be a tremendous breath of fresh air, a very honorable, forthright person. I'm excited about looking forward to your appointment to this position. I will tell you that as the chair of House Judiciary, I believe that it's the governor's right to fill out her dance card, but we want to have the opportunity to enjoy a very thorough vetting so that we understand, not only for the benefit of the House Judiciary Committee, but for the body that we represent, and for the people of Alaska to get a feel on a broad array of issues where you are coming from. And we will appreciate you answering a question in a manner in which you are comfortable, but also with a significant amount of specificity. This is not a confirmation to either the U.S. Supreme Court or the Alaska State Supreme Court. So we are very interested in where you are specifically on issues that are before the state of Alaska, that have been before the state of Alaska, and will come before the state of Alaska in informing policy to reflect not only this governor's wishes, but also the Department of Law, both the appointed members of the Department of Law that enjoy political appointment, but also those members of the Department of Law that make up its backbone and are career members. So we're very interested. We are, as I say, not in any special hurry to conclude this confirmation. So if we go up to 3 o'clock, we will I'll look to you, Mr. Rules Chairman, to see whether I adjourn for the day or whether I just recess this dialogue, and then we will take it up at some other time between now and whenever is convenient for you and your office and our schedule, with the expectation that clearly you will enjoy a positive hearing from this committee. But we want to learn a lot about you because we all like you so much. So with that,
it's a setup.
Yeah. No, it's really not. I'm in hospitality. I'm just being gracious.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
General Tallis should Colbert should consider himself lucky. Most people get commented on how good they look.
You preempted me, Representative Gruenberg.
Go ahead.
General, you look good today. And so with that, the floor is yours, and then we'll open it up to questions.
We'll see how I look at the end.
You'll look fabulous at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Committee, Judiciary Committee, and Representative Olson. Representative Ramos had asked me several times to talk more and to speak a little bit, and so I'd like to take the opportunity to just outline my life a little bit. And for those of you who may have seen the judiciary transcript from the Senate or heard it, I apologize for any redundancy that you may be going through. But basically, I was born in Alaska the year before statehood. My grandparents came to Alaska in 1949 from China. My mother's parents were from Latvia. She was born in Latvia. So my father was born in China. My mother was born in Latvia, which explains why I was born in Alaska. Okay. Family home traditionally has been Palmer, although we've moved around a lot since then, although we end up gravitating back to that area where most of my relatives, including my parents, still live. In the course of those moves, I had the opportunity to live in other parts of Alaska, not confined entirely to the road belt. I lived in a village in southeastern Alaska in fourth and fifth grade, Angoon on Admiralty Island. So I have had the opportunity to have an experience living in what we call Bush Alaska and seeing what the lifestyle is there, not just on a short-term basis, but actually 2 years extended basis. And I have seen in person what it's like to live there and what people go through. And it is a different lifestyle. And in the 1960s, it was a pretty hard lifestyle. Just by way of trivia, Senator Kukash's mother was the postmaster when I lived in Angoon at that time. So my life in Alaska has been in urban, rural, and bush Alaska, and significant amounts of time in each of those areas. In Palmer, I was a good kid. I was in the Key Club. I was the kid with the horn-rimmed glasses and the pocket calculator, and I would raise and lower the flag every day before school started in front of the school for 3 years. That was my little project. I was selected to be one of two Alaskan students statewide to be representative of the state at the National Youth Science Camp in my senior year of high school. I was also selected as one of two seniors statewide to be representative of Alaska at the Bicentennial Seniors, which was, if you remember from 1976, they had the TV commercials that said 200 years ago today in history, and we entered the contest, took an exam, and went through interviews, and I was able to attend that particular meeting. I also was selected to be one of Ted Stevens' interns in his high school program that year, and so I had some very wonderful experiences and representing our state at that point. I went to Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. I majored in Oriental History. My interest there basically emanated from my grandfather of 29 years living in China before he moved to Alaska in 1949. And he would talk constantly of medicine and China. And so I had a predisposition to be interested in that area, and I went on to major in that field. I finished college in 3 years. I worked a year, and then I went to law school at Pepperdine University in Southern California. It was a good experience. I enjoyed it. I also was married in the course of my studies at law school. We had a campus in London. I met my wife there, who was a student at a school called London and Hammersmith College, and she was from Poland. And in a short period of time, it culminated at a meeting at the Serpentine Lake in Hyde Park, where I had bought a ring to put the pressure on her to say yes. She said she couldn't give me an answer that quickly on something that important and needed some time to think about it, so I threw the ring into the lake, and then she became quite angry with me. Seemed to break off our relationship barely for a while, and I returned to a law school in California for 4 days, and then I withdrew whatever tuition I could get back, flew back, and my unannounced arrival back in London at her door, when she opened the door, she said, "Okay, I'll marry you." And so we just celebrated our 25th anniversary last month, and it's been a wonderful experience. My first job out of law school was in Wasilla, Alaska, with a small law firm, Copperud & Heffern, and that was probably the broadest time of my practice of law in terms of general practice. We did a little bit of everything. And within a year, I became very focused in my practice when I went to work for the Travelers Insurance Company in October of 1985 and spent time basically as their staff counsel focusing in workers' compensation, which has been my specialty ever since. There was a period where I was transferred to the Seattle office, and I basically engaged in that period in a little bit broader fields of property casualty defense work for corporate clients. The focus of my practice remained workers' comp, but in 1991-92, I moved back to my hometown Palmer and opened my own practice where I have been a sole practitioner for the last 15 years. And the major difference is not the field. I still practice mainly in workers' compensation, but the emphasis switched from corporate client defense to plaintiff's work for injured workers in Alaska. And in the course of that, I've also had, in a small town, the opportunity to do other things. I briefly did divorce law. I did not care for that. After about 3 years, I stopped doing that. Some small business practice, some wills and trusts and probates. And in the course of that 15-year period, I've had the opportunity to represent about 2,000 Alaskans. I understand people's concerns about the slowness of the legal system, the cost of the legal system, their apprehension about approaching an attorney for help because of the costs associated with it. And the big difference between corporate clients and individual clients is their ability and concern about legal bills and getting some kind of remedy for their problems quickly with some level of certainty, which is hard to provide. The in the same period I was practicing law, I did other things. I did not lose my interest in history, and in the course of the last 15 years, I've also been an adjunct history instructor at the University of Alaska Anchorage Matsu campus, where I have taught between 2 and 3 courses most semesters for the last 15 years. I've had about 1,500 different students in that time period. And I, since this is the opportunity to introduce myself, I would point out that Chancellor Gorsuch even gave me an award in 1999 for outstanding teaching in the work at the university. Along with that, I tried to also pursue studies myself, and I have been in the last 4 years in the PhD program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in their Northern Studies program, working on the PhD program for focus on an individual who would be M.D. Snodgrass, who was an early Alaskan pioneer from the period of 1907 to 1967 when he passed away. He was in the first Board of Regents for the university. He was a founder of the Alaska State Fair in Palmer. He was a territorial legislator from both Fairbanks and Palmer. And he was one of the first 3 electoral vote casters in 1960 for Alaska. And there's a lot of material there. He was someone who interacted with many prominent Alaskans in his lifetime and is not well covered because he's just below the radar screen in that area. That has given me an opportunity to do graduate work and even write comprehensive papers on things that before this happened might have been just solely limited to my personal interest, but may actually be useful in trying to serve as an attorney general, and that I have done work on circumpolar health issues. I have done research into the nature of judicial selection versus election and the pros and cons of the systems that are available. I've done comprehensive papers surveying the history of Alaska, history of Alaska territorial politics, and the origins of state non-native and native fairs and festivals. The I've also had an opportunity to be an elected representative of people on the borough level in the Matanuska Valley. I was elected to 2 terms on the Matanuska Susitna Borough Assembly, and with all due respect to Fairbanks, we're slowly starting to eclipse their area in population. And in the course of my representation, I've represented roughly 10,000 Alaskans for that 6-year period, twice elected to the Assembly. So I'm familiar with Alaska municipal and borough needs, how the government system works there, and that also, I think, would be helpful in the overall approach to my duties as an attorney general. I've also had an opportunity to work statewide on the Alaska Humanities Forum, which is a branch for this state's connection to the National Endowment for the Humanities. Each state has such a board. The Alaska Humanities Forum has projects that aren't necessarily associated with it by name that people would be familiar with, the 2020 project, the Alaska radio show AK on public radio, the leadership Anchorage, and perhaps most pertinent to some of the issues facing the state now, the Rose Urban-Rural Exchange, where we have tried to facilitate having an opportunity for young people especially to travel from urban areas in Alaska to bush areas for a couple weeks at a time and actually live with native families and bring their children back to be hosted by the same families on the other side of the urban-rural divide, as it's sometimes referred to. Okay. In conclusion to my introduction, I would simply point out that while I was labeled as an outsider early on in this process, I have lived in Alaska for almost half a century. I was born here. I'm actually older than most of the people who have ever been named Attorney General in this state. I practiced law longer than most of the people who have been appointed Attorney General when they were appointed. I have been active not only in the legal field, but in the field of our university, not only as a student, but also as an instructor. And I've been active in the civic affairs of our state on a statewide basis, as well as an elected official. And I would look forward to your questions. And it would be nice to finish today, but I understand your concerns if you want to go beyond that. Thank you.
Thank you, General. I'd like to recognize that our good friend and yours, General, Representative Bill Stoltz is here. Representative Stoltz, Representative Dahlstrom's not with us today. You're very welcome to come up here and participate, listen, throw a protective cloak over your friend, General Kohlberg. Not that he needs it. But,
Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Yes. Duly noted. All right, with that, I'd like to throw it open for questions to the General, and I would encourage members to take their time. And in general, we appreciate you showing us patience and specificity in your answers. With that, Representative Lynn.
Yes, thank you for coming in today. And I've gone in a couple of times with a couple of questions, and I'm just amazed how fast an answer got back to us. And I really want to thank you for that. Very good answers. One quick question. Did you go scuba diving for the ring after you threw it in, after she said yes?
Through the chair to Representative Lynn, I appreciate the question. I did actually go look for it when the lake froze over, and I walked out to where I approximately thought it had gone in, and my conclusion was that there was either a mud bottom or that a duck took it to Africa. So I don't.
I guess you qualify as a fiscal conservative.
The second ring was cheaper. And I would also say that thank you for the comment about the quick turnaround on questions, but I can't really take total credit for that by any means. That we have a very good staff.
I'm sure you do, and I know you do. But obviously, you know, you're the one who's responsible, and his staff reflects you, because you work with the staff. I did want to add, there's been some debate, and I know some bills out there and so on what is best, an elective attorney general or an appointed attorney general. Do you have any insight on that? We'll be looking at some of that stuff as we go down the line here.
Yeah, and to be quite honest, had you asked me that question 4 months ago before I knew anything about where I'd be today, my traditional answer was more or less leaning towards the idea that an elected attorney general seemed to be a way to divide power from being too concentrated. Certainly, it's obvious that it also becomes another opposing force that can be something that could be somewhat obstructive, and that a political position could be seen by some people as an opportunity to advance a career as opposed to doing what might be the appropriate thing. I guess the way I would analyze it is when I had looked into the idea of elected judges as a paper for research, not that I would advocate that at any particular point. What's apparent in the case of judges is in this case we have a lack of familiarity with who are the judges, and it shows up in the retention elections when the last round showed most judges being retained by 60% roughly, or 65%, some a little bit higher, which had there been an opponent would be considered a landslide. But the disturbing side note to that would be that over a third of the population seems to be perfectly willing to vote no right across the board on judges without necessarily distinguishing amongst them, and that may be a reflection of the absence of campaigning and explaining who they are so that people know who their judges are. And the other thing that I had learned in the course of looking into that was that there is literature that when people have tried to qualitatively compare elected judges versus selected or combination of judges' selection processes, that in this country, the end result seems to be hard to distinguish that there's a material difference in the quality of justice or the quality of the judiciary from state to state, based on how they're selected in the first place. Does that mean we should alter our system? Not really. But in answer to your question directly, you know, the reason most states have elected attorney generals is that they're comfortable with it. It seems to work also. Our system, I think, has the value of having the idea that a governor and a state are maybe better served by someone who isn't trying to raise funds and promote a particular agenda, but simply trying to do the job in a more neutral fashion so that it's not perceived to be as political. But the fact that it's an appointment by an elected figure doesn't totally eliminate that factor either.
Mr. Chairman, just could I, on that point, yes. Before you get the same question?
How do I know?
I'll defer.
Go ahead, Representative Cockrell.
Representative Cockrell? And then go back to you, Representative Lynn.
Yeah, well, it just begs a question. As an appointed person, there would be a loyalty to the governor. An elected position, there would be a loyalty to the populace. How do you view the difference from where you sit?
Well, I think that the statutes are pretty clear, and my perception would be that not only do the statutes suggest that I am the Attorney General for the whole state and an advisor to the governor, advisor to administration departments, and an advisor to you in many ways, is the intent, and I think in the case of the governor that we have, that's clearly her desire also, that I be as fair and straight with things as possible. And I think perhaps one of the reasons she picked someone that wasn't as well known is she was looking for someone who was not perceived to have an agenda but was just trying to do the job correctly.
Representative Lynn?
Pretty close, but I could imagine, you know, if I were the governor, which I probably never will be, but if I went to my attorney general for advice, I think I'd want that attorney general to be in my same philosophical ballpark when I got that advice, rather than somebody who might be totally opposite from me in their political and philosophical positions. So I could better trust the Attorney General if they were somewhere close to my position on things. And let me segue into another portion of this. I have some other questions later. But when a legislator needs advice, we can go to Ledge Legal and get advice from this side, or this branch of government, usually pretty good advice. And we also, as I've done recently with you, asked a couple of questions and gotten advice. And sometimes, as lawyers do, you know, you don't get the same opinion. What's a poor legislator who's a layman to do when you get one set of advice from Ledge Legal and another set of advice from the Attorney General?
Weigh them both carefully and go with the Attorney General.
Excellent answer, General.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cockrell.
I just want to press the issue a little bit more on how you view this, because there are various different ways you could think of as a client relationship, for example. The governor, the people, various different agencies. So I got this. Well, I won't bring that up. So you have the public interest, the governor, and the individual clients that you have to deal with. How do you see your role as a protector of their interests?
Yeah, it's clearly an issue that's been around for a while, and I guess where I'd start to answer the question is I would divide, first of all, between policies and the law. And I think that having a general policy direction and being in alignment with that is one thing. If it gets to the point where it hits a point of legality, I think it's important not to be trying to bend a legal opinion to fit a policy goal just because I think it meets what the governor wants to hear. So I think the law is something that I would hope, and this is where, you know, one of the things that I've learned very quickly in the course of just the few months that I've been here is that, you know, we have a staff of people who are focused on different areas, and when a question comes up, you know, I suppose some people might say, well, you know, who's doing this and what's their leaning? But I think generally speaking, the staff is something that you can rely upon. I mean, generally trying to do the business of giving a proper legal opinion. And so when I'm working to try to answer questions and I get opinions from the staff, I'm starting out with a general presumption, unless there's something added to the picture that would lead me to believe otherwise, that they're trying to give me the right answer. And that would be the direction that I would be trying to begin with and trying to answer questions that might very well end up involving policy questions. And I would like to think that when it comes down to giving the right answer, it may not always be the popular answer, but that's where I'd like to be in the end.
Appreciate it.
Representative Samuel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on the potential conflicts then between if the governor is your client or you assign one of, how many attorneys, 300-400 attorneys?
280, roughly, 116 on the criminal side, roughly, and that probably changes on a week-to-week basis to a certain degree, and about 160 on the civil side.
So Mr. Tillery assigns one of his attorneys to the pick a department to board a game, board a fish. How is your management style going to be when the advice that they ask on an issue, it goes up the chain of command, it goes to Mr. Tillery, and then it comes to you, and then you look at what the governor's policy choice will be. Is your client then the board? Is your client the public? And how much, I mean, Charlie Cole quit over things just like this with Governor Hickel. And I'm just wondering, how do you picture managing the department with this huge number of lawyers as the conflicts for the advice that they are asked to be from the Department of Law for your position and juggling the politics and versus the law? And it goes back to the original question on whether you do elect where then you work for the people, period. The AG works for the people, as opposed to now you work for the governor. And how do you picture yourself as an individual? It's more of a philosophical question. Sure. On your management style.
Yeah, well, the way I would answer it is, again, just on the brief experience so far, take, for example, Representative Lynn had provided a couple questions to me. Part of what I would tell you is I don't then turn around and run by the governor's office, Representative Lynn's questions. I turn around, delegate the questions out. When the answer comes back, I review it so I have some awareness of it. So when he would get back to me, if he had follow-up questions, I would be able to become the point of contact. But I don't see it as my job to try to redirect everything through another chain so that I'm somehow reporting on your questions to someone else. I think that if an agency had a couple times, this has happened already, where a commissioner will have a question, I then don't, again, try to run it through someone else. I try to basically compartmentalize, because clearly the statute says I'm there to provide a service to all these different areas. Is it inconceivable that there would be issues that would interest several people? No, that certainly could arise. And I think that you are right in pointing out that, using the example of General Cole, in fact, I suspect that's arisen more often than people may suspect, because if you look at the average tenure of an attorney general, if you take out Bruce Botello and Abram Gross, you start to get an average of about less than 2 years per attorney general. And so there is quite a turnover there. And it may very well have something to do with a variety of factors, but that would be probably one of them, where people are trying to do what they think is right and maybe feel too pressured to do something they don't think is the right opinion being sought when they've given it. I can't speak to the details of why. In fact, it's a little ambiguous at times why he left and the biography I read about him, and that it just, but it implied that.
Mm-hmm. So if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
And once again, just trying to get to know you a little
sure.
bit. Philosophically sure. speaking, then, you've got your 160 civil attorneys giving advice to various agencies on various things. How much of it comes to your level where you are having to see, here's the advice they give on this issue, and reading the briefs? Does it get to Mr. Tillery's level? how much autonomy does the individual have, and how much fear do you have then that you have two people, one with the Board of Fish and one with the Board of Game, that have the same question with a different opinion? Does it all flow back to you management-wise, or do you have autonomy for your individual attorneys?
Okay, through the chair, Representative Samuels, I have to believe I'm not seeing everything just because the workload of 280 attorneys would, I would imagine, pretty much floor. And we definitely have division heads. And I know that there are levels of authority that have to come to me. So I know I see in civil matters cases involving large settlements that have gone through committees where they haven't approached me beforehand to say, what do you think? But they've reached a consensus of what they want to do. And then they make a recommendation to me, and I do my best to try to respect the recommendations that are made, and I really can't think of one where I've said, no, absolutely, don't do that particular settlement, but there haven't been that many at this point. But things are filtered to get to me, for sure, and that is undoubtedly happening on a daily basis. If I thought there was something more that... I also get communications from incredible variety of sources on a daily basis. I mean, it's an adjustment just to edit emails each day off of the machine so I can not pile up to get to the new ones. But people manage to get to me sometimes in amazing ways. And so I think if something was happening that I wasn't being told about deliberately, and it was significant over a period of time especially, I would eventually find out about it one way or another, and I would look into that.
Okay, and then just make sure I understand, if you were king right now, would you rather have an elected AG, or would you rather have an appointed AG?
For this governor, an appointed AG is...
But for a policy for the state of Alaska right now, there's probably a piece of legislation somewhere in the body right now.
I know that the bias institutionally in the AG's office is that an elected AG would be bad, and I know that in Steve Haycock's history of attorneys general, apparently only two of the 16 he'd covered in the book were in favor of electing. But I think it would be inconsistent for me to suggest that I would be against an elected AG after having most of my life been somewhat sympathetic to it. I'm not advocating it for this governor in this case because I think it would be ridiculous. But frankly, if you implemented legislation to elect an AG, I mean, I'm not adverse to the concept. It's I'm happy for the opportunity to serve, and if people switched to an elected AG, that would have been something I would have voted for a year ago.
I could just interrupt your questioning. I'm just popped into my head. Would you have run?
Would I have run? No.
Would you have run for Attorney General?
No.
Okay. Representative Cockham.
Unless somebody else. The position of the AG then brings me to the question of the state-federal relationships, and there's a number of things that are happening between the states and the feds with ANILCA, with our fisheries policy, with our water, our rivers and waters. Certainly we live in two-thirds of the land masses is run by the federal government, so the pressure is not unrealistic. But one of the areas where the feds haven't made a decision that I would like to see an attorney general and a governor take to the feds and say, make a decision, and that is on the federal tribal status. We have for money purposes coming into Alaska, we have money coming into various different tribal groups. But it's been kind of the way of establishing a sovereignty movement that really is inappropriate, in my view, and puts us in huge tension as to how do we enforce criminal laws, how do we enforce child enforcement safety laws, how do we do all these various different laws. And we've had kind of this flex system because we have people acting like they have sovereignty. We have the feds that won't address the issue, but they keep giving money and they keep calling various different things tribal, which they won't define. Puts our police in a bad position, puts you in the Department of Law in a bad position, puts us as legislatures in a bad position. So is there something that you, or you and the governor, have got focused on trying to get this thing resolved?
There's certainly an interest in trying to resolve this issue. Is there an answer that's already laid out by the governor or myself? No. It is something that, if I were to be confirmed and had time to work on it, I would love to be the focus of my tenure as an attorney general. It is an incredibly complicated deal. I think that the history behind it has a lot to do with our remoteness geographically and a certain amount of federal neglect and exceptionalism for how Alaska came to be treated so differently as a territory. Our organic acts were quite different from the standard organic acts implemented in most states. Most of them had provisions for self-government and elected government on a threshold basis based on population. Those were even altered by Abraham Lincoln in the case of Nevada to make it less of a population requirement, but when they got to Alaska, they in fact left out key provisions, which meant that we had no government at all until 1884, and then when we got it, it was elected officials appointing people at a federal level and not having any elections in Alaska till 1906, when we had a non-voting federal elected delegate. The second Organic Act in 1912 gave us some more rights, but by that time, you already had, by this neglect and space, a situation where a significant part of the native population of Alaska, especially in the north and the interior, would have good reason not to know that they're being governed by anyone, even at that stage, because they hadn't had much contact. And so what then happens in 1912 is we have some provisions for government, but certainly no provision, for example, for counties. And so unlike most territories that became states, we had no experience with really developing a structure for county government. And so by the time you get to the Indian Reorganization Acts in 1934 and 1936, the government starts to basically recognize tribes in the vacuum of really having no surrounding structure to the contrary. And so by the time we get to statehood and then our own Borough Act in the early 60s, 63, 64, we're creating two systems. We had a BIA school system. We had a non-native school system. Those things had had time to kind of continue, develop their own constituency. And so that neglect over that long period of long-distance rule and to be treated differently, where we weren't given the tools to develop as other states, makes it even more awkward when we get to things like the Indian Child Welfare Act, which has a sense of application in other states with clear reservations, but we have one reservation, and what's the status of where it applies in areas where there's tribes recognized by the federal government but no territory associated with it. And while the Venati case may have declared there's no Indian country, we are, as you put it, in this hodgepodge or quilt of competing jurisdictions which aren't consistent. And I guess part of the solution may be in looking at an institution like the legislature, where we have all bodies, all constituencies represented here, where they're participating in it and they recognize it as an institution that's legitimate. It would be nice if you think there was a way to guide the system away from the uncertainties that litter the landscape with the uncertain status of the different entities with relation to each other, something that everyone can agree upon. But there certainly is a lot of sensitivity in the Native community about the past that's on the minds of many of them, that makes them very apprehensive about surrendering what they perceive as sovereignty by engaging in relationships. And my own relation with this has come to more of a focus point in this position in the role as a co-chair of the Rural Justice Commission, where we spend a huge amount of time trying to figure out how to apply the Indian Child Welfare Act to in a way where the state can have a role and not end up simply being responsible and for liability but not for regulation, and at the same time provide a service that's not being provided to areas that feel a need to have a service because it isn't their And it's a tangle that's not easy to sort out, and I wish I could say I have the solution, but I would like to work on a solution, and I think it needs attention, and I'd be willing to make it a focal point.
Representative Coghill.
One of the solutions I see is that we go to Congress and ask them to make some determinations that are more clear on what they intend on tribal status. I mean, certainly we can look at our court cases, but I, for one, am not willing to divide Alaska up so definitively that we end up holding each other in contempt. I think that would be the wrong thing to do, and we're heading in that direction. Mm-hmm. So what could the governor do? What could you, as Attorney General, working with a governor, appeal to Congress to get, for example, the list of tribes, it was ever only meant to be a way to get money into some of their fiduciary issues, like health care or Indian child welfare issues. I think it's being misused without any direction from Congress. Can we, as a state, appeal with our court cases, with the Supreme Court cases, with the Ninth Circuit Court, and you appealing to Congress to help us get that settled? Would you be willing to go to Congress and say, get a determination to us?
I would be willing to try to pursue any kind of avenue possible. I think that one of the things that I had met with early on, Mr. Popley and Mr. There's an author of a book. It's Mitchell, Don Mitchell. Both had met, and you know, I think they were of the persuasion that a case that would lead to critical decisions one way or the other was one of the methods that would be reaching a conclusion. And clearly, there were opportunities that were kind of backed off in the past from continuing litigation in that way. And I can surmise that one of the reasons for that was that such a type of decision making, while it would give answers, might leave someone bit embittered in a way that might be hard to get over for quite some time. Going to Congress may be a less confrontational method of doing things like that, and probably the governor would probably be a more effective person in terms of being heard or having the stature to do that. I suspect part of the reason why a Rural Justice Commission was created is that it was a way for Congress to at least show some interest in it, but maybe, you know, I can't explain why they wouldn't have made an effort to address it more in the way you've already discussed, if it's not for the different constituencies tugging at them already on this very same issue.
I've got a whole range of questions on this issue, but knowing that you're willing to at least pursue looking into it is helpful to me, because if we do not begin to answer the question and go to Congress with suggested answers, then we are the ones that get into pain, not the feds. they don't really care. It's up to us to figure out a solution, go to them with that solution. And the Rural Justice Commission is a federal look into it and maybe a good vehicle, but they came to ask about what's going on in villages that's not working. It really wasn't about what is the legal structure. It was really about
what's
the
social impact. No, you're right. It's a point where I've had an opportunity to focus on a couple issues where the overall questions tend to get into who is in charge here and who's responsible.
And, Mr. Chairman, part of the history that you cited was very good, and I think it was in 1916, after we got our Organic Act, that we were allowed to meet as a legislature. And I think it was in the second legislature that met that Alaskans petitioned Congress for citizenship for natives. We're way ahead of the rest of the world on that, and it didn't happen until 1924.
Yeah, and through the chair to Representative Coghill, I think the first legislature was 1913.
Got me.
It's rare, General, that anybody trumps Representative Coghill on Alaskan history.
And I should
there's a big mark right there. That's a good one.
I would like to withdraw my correction.
No. It was nicely done. I'm slightly in awe. Representative Lynn.
Yes, while we're on the federal area here, there's some talk of the wilderness area for Anwar, and I guess it's the, was it Jay Hammond Wilderness Area down at Bristol Bay, I think it is, and someone's had some big concerns about that, and what can we do in Alaska to handle that situation? What can you do, what can we do legally to stop the federal government from creating these wilderness areas in these two places and heaven knows where else?
Well, I, as I understand through the chair to Representative Lynn, the you're talking about the Pebble Bay, Pebble Mine area.
That's part of it, yes.
And I had heard about proposed legislation in this body. I had not realized it was already coming as a federal legislation as well. What could we do about it? I would have to say I'd have to look into it and find out more about it. I think if it's, I had the impression that Representative Edgemon and Senator Gary Stevens had both introduced different approaches to designating land in that area differently. I had not known it was going to be a federal.
Through the chair, I thought it was coming from the Fed. I know that some of our representatives have, but I don't know what to. You know, I thought I know that Anwar, I believe, is a federal move, or trying to work through the feds to create a wilderness area in Anwar. I'm sure.
Oh, in Anwar, for sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Leaving Pebble out of it. What defense do we have through the law in Alaska to guard against such things?
Well, I if it's at the federal level, I guess what comes to mind most quickly is the 1980 Alaska public land, national interest lands, and I'm not sure that the state outside of our federal representation has a huge role to play. We certainly can lobby. Can we preempt federal legislation on creating parks? I don't know enough about that area to know that, but I, as I recall, we were, as a state at the time, not generally in favor of the massive expansion of the park system in the state, and I don't think there was very much effective resistance to it actually happening from the state itself.
And just,
that may have been looked into.
I observed part of the press conference today, the governor, and you were there, and you made some comments. And as Attorney General, what did the governor presented her plan on AGIA, which is the Gasoline Inducement Act. And what are the major issues on AGIA that, as we proceed toward the gas pipeline, from the Attorney General's viewpoint, potential litigation and so on? What hurdles do you see we may have to jump over to get the gas pipeline?
Well, I don't see litigation coming from the GIA bill itself. What's quite likely in any project of that magnitude is that once things are at the position where there's a proposal and going beyond a proposal to actually doing things, it's quite likely that there'll be all sorts of types of litigation associated with things that people may come to feel are worth pursuing for financial reasons. But it's hard for me to imagine the details of what that litigation would be. I don't foresee litigation coming from the presentation that was made today.
Thank you. But
General, a couple of quick questions. Were you a member of the law review?
No, I was not.
Were you a member of the Order of the Coif, which is the National Law School Honor Society for individuals in the top 10% of their class?
No, but I was a member of Phi Kappa Phi, the honor academic fraternity for graduate work.
What was your class ranking?
In law school? I would say I was in the middle. I don't know the number.
In the middle. I'm not throwing rocks. I'm a middler. Your competent people come from the middle. In fact, studies show that the most remarkable people come from the middle. So one middle guy to another. I like you, General. I'm just asking. I got a good list of questions here. Representative Stoltz, I'll ask you where you were in that ranking later after we're out of committee. trial experience, please, in state court and then in federal court?
I've been involved in administrative law with workers' compensation, which is appearing before a panel, which I have, there are occasionally appeals from that, but no, I have not had trial experience since the first year when I had the general experience with one small law firm, and that was at the very beginning. So for the last 22 years, it's been administrative law.
Following on Representative Lynn's question regarding AGEA, and I understand work comp, I get that, but have you pursued, do you feel like there's any breadth in your experience in the area of oil and gas law, natural resource law? We already discussed a little bit about laws that relates to tribes or Alaska Native groups, tax code. Do you have you read extensively? Do you follow those things? Have you had any experience in those areas?
Not in the field of law. That's not been the area, and it would be, frankly, the one area where I would say I have some knowledge about and relates to Alaska Native history and the historical side of things and the history of how we've had a relationship with federal government. What I guess I can just, since the line of questioning is in terms of specialization, there are 13 separate divisions in the civil side alone that specialize, and most of the people don't tend to do anything other than their specialty, and that's beneficial to the state. The fact of the matter is that I rely, as I've already indicated, on the expertise of the staff in those areas, and if in the case of oil and gas and AGEA, I would also point out that while we do have 12 positions, although maybe it's 10 filled right now in that department, even the attorneys that specialize in oil and gas matters have spent literally, as you probably know, millions of dollars on even more specialized attorneys that they rely on to follow into the details of what they're doing. And that also, in my mind, is a reasonable way to do it. So, no, I would not try to represent myself as a specialist in anything other than what I did, which is workers' compensation.
As a member of the business community in my private sector capacity, quick couple of questions on your area of specialty. In work comp, who did you most often represent?
The first 7 years I represented employers insured by the Travelers Insurance Company. For the last 15 years, I've represented workers.
Following on that question, I also was at the governor's press conference today, and I was very pleased. I'm on the record, a tremendous advocate of AGEA as a methodology and an initial vehicle, especially once we get to shape it and help improve it. So I'm very hopeful that this is going to be a way to realize the Alaskan's dream to get a gas line and to get it soon. But after we have succeeded at that, since I anticipate that Governor Palin will be our governor for the next 7 3/4 years, and I look forward to it. Will you be able to lend a hand with further modifying our work comp laws? Because I have been a victim of workers' comp for 20 plus years now, and it has gotten progressively worse. The victimization of employers across the state of Alaska has gotten worse in the last few years. We, in Representative Olson's Labor and Commerce Committee, we had an overview from the Director of Insurance, and as she indicated, the Alaskans pay more for workers' comp than any other state in the nation. So I asked the question in its inverse: if we pay more than any other state in the nation, then shouldn't it reason that we have better protection and better benefits for our injured workers than any other state in the nation? And she answered with a resounding no, that's not the case. And I sat through the worker comp legislation over the last couple of years, and as an employer and as a legislator who's fairly knowledgeable about comp, all I could tell my constituents is that we took one black box that was horrible and traded it for another black box that was largely a mystery to me. And I know you worked very hard on that, Representative Coghill. And although we have all realized some rate reductions, largely it's because the market has softened and not necessarily from the initiatives that came from that, with all due respect, Representative Coghill. Do you have the wherewithal to turn your attention as a secondary effort behind the AGEA to try and further modify and improve our work comp system for the benefit of employers in the private sector across the state of Alaska?
I would certainly be willing to apply what I know, and I guess one advantage I have is having been on both sides, I can see a lot of the issues from two different perspectives at this point in my life.
General, because we're trying to get to know you, to paraphrase my friend Representative Samuels, what would you do specifically? What are some of the ways that you would attack that area, since this is the area of law in which you do enjoy a great deal of specificity of practice and specialized knowledge? What changes would you make in that area? What would you advocate in that area?
Well, I think if you take a comprehensive look at where the costs are, because the state generates from all the carriers annual reports that give some information that gives you a statistical overview, you can start to see that, like many areas similarly in our country, healthcare is the overwhelming core of the cost, and there's an unfortunate perception that high costs in workers' comp are necessarily attributed to the folks who are abusing it on an individual collecting it. And so I think that you need to be able to separate the factors. Workers' comp benefits actually were higher for individual workers before the 1988 changes. The weekly compensation rate was dropped and slowly kind of incrementally worked up. But the cost didn't necessarily reflect the decrease in benefits to the employees. And so, you know, what can you do about the medical cost is another question, because healthcare outside of workers' comp is also one of the fastest growing areas of cost. I mean, everyone sees it, whether it's pension plans or healthcare premiums for people or just general group health insurance. It's workers' comp has no deductible, and there's reasons for that. You go back to, if you look in old records, you can find that there's an old contract that exists from when the Kennecott mine was in action that workers would have to sign off that if they were injured on the job, they would bear the cost of their transportation home, their own medical care, and it was their problem. It's a different world now, and so, the premise is that if you take away the threat of personal injury lawsuits and guarantee care for someone who's truly injured, it's a trade-off, and if that guaranteed care is a serious injury that requires long-term care, it tends to get to be where there's an awful lot of litigation about what is appropriate care, what's ameliorative care versus curative care. How do you get a handle on what makes someone seem to feel better and as opposed to what's making them actually get better? And if you get into workers' comp long enough, you start to see that it's not as clear as you would expect. There's most workers' comp disputes tend to come down, if they get into protracted litigation, about which doctor is right. And there's an incredible amount of disagreement in the medical community on a case-by-case basis of what's the appropriate treatment, what's the appropriate malad, what's really going on here. There are a lot of doctors who see the same person and have completely different opinions on a day-to-day basis. And, how do you get a handle on that? Well, what was created was the idea of independent medical exams and then the idea of second independent medical exams, which themselves have become quite costly. And who bears the cost on that tends to be the employers. How do you regulate that without losing the interest of doctors in participating? Well, absent more regulation, you're going to have exceptional billing on a case. And while you have exceptions that can result in literally medical exams, not taking someone as a patient, but exams that can run not just thousands of dollars anymore, but in some cases in the last couple of years, in $10,000 or more for a medical exam to examine an employee, you again see a reflection that, where is the money going and how do you get a handle on it? To restrict that is going to tend to bring doctors to the point where some already are. I just don't want to participate. Some doctors won't participate in this system because they don't want to be deposed, which often happens in workers' comp cases. Doctors are constantly being brought into this, And one way that seems to be resulting in more costs is they charge significantly for their depositions. It's their time. They don't like to go through it. And so if you can get doctors willing to participate, it's the system that is discouraging them to the point where they're charging more. So I think it has to be looked at comprehensively, and just reducing the benefits or trying to restructure retraining by itself doesn't really address where the core of the driver is on the cost, and the cost is what's really aggravating people.
Thank you, General. Along those lines, one of the questions I have, and I got a lot of them, I'm very fortunate, is Rule 1.3 of the Alaska Rules of Professional Conduct requires an attorney to act with commitment and dedication to the interest of the client and with zeal in advocacy upon the client's behalf. So this question says, if you were confirmed, who do you believe will be your client for the purposes of Rule 1.3? Governor Palin, the people of Alaska, or the public interest? And the way that I'd like to fashion that question to follow on my last question is, because this is a special area of specific interest that to me is quite unresolved when I speak on behalf of the various constituencies that I represent in the private sector, will you be prepared with Governor Palin to readdress workers' comp to make it, if it's the most expensive work comp in the nation, then it ought to have the greatest set of benefits for the workers? And if that's not the case, then I sure would like to see Alaska lose its number one ranking, because as a private employer in the private sector, I am so unhappy. I have been made to be such a victim. And I know that each of us bring our areas of specialty to the legislature and often represent areas in which we are most familiar. What kind of a commitment can we get to you today that once you learn this job and you've been around the horn for a year and you put a GIA to bed, because I believe that will happen to some degree swiftly, can you commit to us? I want to phrase that in the appropriate way. So will you work on the work comp problem by way of Governor Palin to please help rescue those people that are in the private sector that are just getting wrecked by a horrible system? With your vast experience in that area, if you could bring a fix and a remedy and some help and to protect the people of Alaska, the injured workers, because nobody wants to see them shortchanged, but to offer some much-needed help to employers across the state. Is that an area where you do have specific special knowledge and could put your shoulder to the wheel and really turn it a little bit for the public good?
Well, I guess your question gets back into, who do I work for? And the first part of it is I do believe I work for the people of the state of Alaska. I think it would probably be a bad precedent for me to commit to one legislator that I would promise to prioritize, with all due respect, that particular issue without really running afoul of 69 others who might say, that's not my priority. Why did you commit to him because he was the chairman? I think that's where the role of the governor tends to be a factor in. I'm part of a cabinet, and as you pointed out, AGIA is the focal point right now. Would I be willing to participate in working on workers' compensation legislation? Absolutely. Would I set aside everything else up front because you happen to be the first person to quit? I think that would be a bad concept.
I agree, and if you'll just allow me, gentlemen, I agree, and it would be irresponsible of me to suggest that. However, just sitting here, as we were talking about the things that you haven't got special knowledge of, it occurred to me that this is an area in which you do have special knowledge, and I, for one, as a legislator, was very satisfied with the process, especially because Representative Conkill, I know, worked extensively on this issue. But as a member of the private sector, and in speaking to my peer group in the private sector, we were so unhappy that we medical caps, the 2005 medical caps, and I don't want to go into work comp, it's not the appropriate place for it.
2004.
Was it
2004?
And but we would we are desperate for some help, and that is an area where you have special knowledge and expertise. And so I would plead my case on behalf of many in the private sector that as the wheel turns and you have the opportunity to put your hands on an area of the law where you do have special knowledge, please consider trying to streamline, fix, refine that problem, because you understand it uniquely from both places. And as the Attorney General of the State of Alaska, a bill that was by request of Governor Palin would enjoy an expeditious hearing through the legislature, and the private sector needs more help in that area. So I would encourage you on that point to help us. Representative Cockio?
Mr. Chairman, can I change subjects?
Certainly, yeah.
Really isn't changing subjects. Your historical perspective is going to be absolutely great to work with. It's going to be exciting, and I appreciate that. Because of the history of Alaska growing not only with the Indian population and the federal land issues, we have several unresolved issues. And then a couple that I'd like to see a challenge. And if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, I'd like to go down at least three of them and then highlight one that looms over all of them. The reserve water rights issue with Mr. Kempthorne in the place that he's at, this is probably the time to continually working on them. And it's going to require the Department of Law to maintain an aggressive stance, I think, on working with our Department of Natural Resources on exerting the reserve water rights, submerged lands. The way they've been doing that is through the recordable disclaimers. And I think it's the right system. There's a willingness to work. Now, RS-2477 is the other issue. It probably is not going to be quite so easy. DNR has been moving slowly on it. It's expensive because of litigation. I think we have to get some of our land titles settled before we really make that work well, I think. But the overarching issue to me is how the federal government fails to understand the agreement made in Congress on the ANILCA laws. I think the people of Alaska who use this land in a variety of ways, natives, non-natives, in holdings, our mining laws, are all under huge pressure by misinterpretation of ANILCA. Is it your intention to look into that and to assert that law before Congress? I really feel that we need to.
Certainly my intention to look into it. I think that's very much part of the whole picture with relation to what we talked about earlier in terms of sovereignty and where boundaries are and who's in charge of what. I'm sure a circumstance will arise where the decision will have to be made as to what we will be trying to pursue, and we are very conscious of the state's need to protect its interests, and that is something.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I should be specific. Would you be willing to put a lawsuit on the federal government by not applying ANILCA correctly?
To initiate an incorrect application of ANILCA?
Yes.
To
by suing. And you don't have to answer that today, but yeah. that's an answer yeah. I'm looking for.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, I would prefer to think about that one rather than announce something that I'm not sure.
General, that's why we're so excited about having you back. Representative Gruenberg and then Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to explore two areas with you. One issue that you were questioned on in the Senate was the issue involving the standard to remove a regent, the legal standard. And I've distributed to the members of the committee, along with the list of the Senate questions, copies of the two legal memoranda that I have, and I know that the senators had. And although they differ somewhat on whether the governor has the power to remove a regent without cause, I think they would agree that the governor has the power to remove the regent with cause after a hearing. And you and I briefly discussed whether legislation on that subject would be beneficial. To explicitly state that, I would ask whether you would investigate that with the governor so that we can see whether legislation should be introduced and enacted that specifically gives the governor the authority to remove a regent with cause after a hearing. Any comment?
As I indicated before the hearing, I would be happy to follow through with that.
I don't know whether we would have to define good cause in that legislation, but if that would be beneficial, your advice on that subject would also be appreciated. I think that the question also should be addressed in that legislation, whether it could be made effective now, even though the cause has occurred previously.
Okay.
That's the first, I don't know, I guess you're in charge.
I got the gavel.
That's what General Haig said, too.
Mr. Gruenberg, you may continue to talk, because I said so.
Thank you, whoever you are. That was addressed to the rules chair. The second question is something that I haven't discussed with anybody at this table, and I don't know if anybody's aware of it. But up until about 10, 15 years ago, we had in this state what we called an open primary. Everybody got the same ballot, and everybody could vote for anybody they wanted. They could vote for one Democrat for one office and a Republican for another office. To make a long story short, in a case called the California Democratic Party versus Jones, an identical California law was struck down, and that subsequently required the Alaska Supreme Court to strike our laws down, too. The state of Washington had a similar law. So California, Washington, and Alaska basically had the same law. There was language in the Jones U.S. Supreme Court decision that stated that a law could be enacted slightly differently, that would survive federal constitutional challenge. And it's a law similar to the Louisiana primary law, where the top two candidates, regardless of party, would go on to the general election. Subsequently, by initiative, the voters of the state of Washington enacted such a law. The political parties brought suit in the federal district court, the District Court of Washington, to invalidate that on the same basis. And the federal district court struck it down on the political party's right of association simply because the law provided that candidates would list after their name their party affiliation. As I recall, that was the only partisan aspect of the law, and they said that that impinged on the party's right of association. That federal district court decision was rendered in 2003, as I recall. Last year, the Ninth Circuit upheld the district court's decision, rendering the Washington state law unconstitutional, affirming the decision. This Monday, in a very surprising move, the U.S. Supreme Court took cert on that case. And I don't think that that has received virtually any publicity around here, although it has in the state of Washington. But that could have profound implications as far as most voters in this state go, because it would enable either this legislature or an initiative to be enacted that would bring back an open primary. I would like you to explore whether the state of Alaska would be willing to file an amicus curiae brief in support of the top two primary. I don't need an answer now, but it's most important. I think I'm speaking for most of my constituents, and I suspect most Alaskans would very much support that. And I'd ask if you would consider filing an amicus brief and respond on that.
And you don't have to respond because there would be profound disagreement on this committee on that one.
I have not thought about this before today.
There might be well profound disagreement with some members of this committee, but I don't think among the electorate. I think most electorate. I'd like an answer to that.
And in this way, the temporary chairman would disagree with the member from very, very vehemently. So,
I'd welcome that debate.
In fact, I'm going to even go so bold as to correct one of your statements. It wasn't the party's right of free association. It was individuals' right of free association.
Well, regardless, the question is, would the state be willing to file a brief?
And I don't have any idea on that.
I understand. A subsequent response would be appreciated at your earliest convenience. Thank you.
Can I change subject?
Well, just
sure.
On that, I think it might be wise, though, since this has come, and it's the first I've heard about this, to look into this matter. So if this issue comes up again later, you'd be familiar with it and can give us the proper advice, whatever the advice would be.
I have the copies of the opinion and the cites and everything in my office. I was planning to bring them, but happy to give them to you.
I'm sure I have folks who can find that real quickly. I'm sure there's a staff behind me that can find it really quickly.
They're smiling, grinning, or is that a grimace? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And I was hoping you would say something else, but not expect me.
Chime in. In fact, it was the two governors ago that bill got introduced because of the Supreme Court ruling, and it was one of the bills I took particular interest in. So, and one of the very few times that I agreed with the Supreme Court. No, I'm just kidding. I found their ruling was very good. Representative Samuels, you had
something? Thank you. Back to some of the tribal status questions, and also interplay that between the relationship between an attorney general and his client, the governor, or his client, the people. I keep coming back to that question over and over, but then General Botello originally had litigation in the Venati case, and then Governor Knowles convinced him that was not a wise course of action. What's your opinion? First of all, was Botello right when he filed it, or was Knowles right when he quashed it? And number two, the relationship, I'd like your comments on the relationship between the Attorney General and the Governor. When one was the attorney and one was the politician, it kind of suspect to why decisions were made in that fashion. And I'd like to hear your opinion on the merits of it, and then also, once again, back to the relationship between a governor and an attorney general and who you work for. Do you work for the people, doing what you think is right, or do you work for the governor as an individual?
Well, I think that probably is a good illustration of where I was going before, the distinction between policy and law. And when I read through Attorney General Botello's explanations in Attorney General opinions that were directed to him by members of the legislature when that was happening, that clearly was kind of the set origin of some of the pointed questions to him that he was answering in those opinions. You are right. He absolutely had a couple of lawsuits, I believe, at the time that were simply dropped. And in his opinion, he makes a point of saying that the legal merits had not changed. He essentially, I think, I've got to be real careful to paraphrase him because I think he would have been very careful how he worded it. But it was basically something to the effect that there may be better ways to resolve these issues than this matter. And so I think what he was doing there was saying that as a lawyer, he felt they had a case and they could have pursued it. He didn't say that the merits of his ability to pursue and possibly win it had changed. But you can see the dynamic that was probably going on there between the governor and him, saying that this was at the governor then, that there was perhaps a different way to approach this. And so he didn't change his opinion, as I can see, as much as say, there's another way to approach this. If, as opposed to having said something to the effect, our case is wrong, or the merits of our case are wrong, which would have appeared to be trying to change the legal opinion at the same time, which I don't think he did.
Do you think we're still in limbo on the issue and have not?
Well, there are definitely issues in limbo. And, you know, I think that goes back to Acting Chair Coghill's question about, you know, bringing a case in a NILCA. Is one of the problems with cases, I think there were two cases there, is that it's hard to know that you would solve everything with a case. You'd certainly get answers on particular situations. And that may be, you know, part of the argument for not litigating is that you may get a more comprehensive answer to some of the disagreements in another way. And maybe you won't. And maybe the festering uncertainty is harmful in the long run. And, you know, had there been a couple Supreme Court decisions that had been pursued at that time, you know, who knows where we would be, but there would have probably been some answers that would have at least clarified, like the Venati did on a particular issue. Is there Indian country? No. Did that solve everything? No, but it was an answer that limits the picture more. So, yeah, I think that would be an example of the difference between policy and law.
So do you think that they should have continued?
I think that it probably, you know, I think what happens is, and you're looking back in retrospect, and I'm adding into the picture in my own mind, I think it coincided with the Millennium announcement, if I'm correct. It may be a little bit off timing-wise, and I think that was meant to be an initiative that led to something that solved something, and I think ultimately it really led to a lot more uncertainty than anything else, because it built up an expectation without a follow-through on one side. So, you know, had you had the lawsuits go forward absent the Millennium Agreement, you might have had some definition of parameters that would have been helpful. But you probably also would have had a heightened level of bitterness, possibly by one side or the other, that may have gone away with time. Time does cure a lot of things. But I've read through the opinions, but I haven't really tried to put myself in the position of trying to second guess it entirely at the time. I can see why it would have been helpful to have more certain answers, and if it is something that can reach a comprehensive solution in the next few years, then maybe it would have been a better approach. But if it's nothing resolved in 5 or 10 years from now, people may look back and say, boy, we would have had an answer there that would have helped clarify things a long time ago, and we just postponed it 3 decades.
So I appreciate that comment. So from where we are now, then looking forward, the administration did act the way they did, and we find ourselves where we are now. What an earlier Representative Coghill asked, do you think you should approach Congress to clarify these issues for us? And do you still think that is something that you will do? And you think it's a wise move to just go to Congress and go speak up on the tribes? Where are we on this thing so we don't have this constant limbo going on right now? Is that something that the administration, or you as the Attorney General, will move forward on?
It's something I could recommend. I guess I'm a little bit unclear if Congress would be willing to address it. But I think the question would be helpful to ask, because if they were, obviously that would take the burden off of a lot of folks and get an answer that's fairly authoritative if they're willing to step into that.
Okay, I'll come back to that a little bit. You go right ahead.
What I'd like to do is go to a question on how you see the Department of Law. Are there things that you have in mind that are changes in the way you manage the Department of Law, things that you want to see happen in prosecution? Are there certain crime sets, do you think, that have been neglected? Do you see department heads focused on their mission? So can you give us an idea of, from your now that you've gotten to Department of Law, you've had a look kind of in the breadth, and you're starting to drill down, is there a specific departmental vision that you're going to start pushing forward?
I don't have a feeling myself that I have a comprehensive enough knowledge of the divisions to say I have a vision of where I want to go with it. I'm really still learning an awful lot about the people that work in the department. And frankly, I've been in Juneau most of the time since the session has started, and the core of the employee base is in Anchorage, and then spread out throughout the 13 offices total, and I have not been to at least 10 of them, if not 11, maybe 10, I guess. I would be just spontaneously creating a vision right here that I have not had time to dwell on.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to hand the gavel back over after I ask this next question. I better not do that. One of the concerns that we have is, as we talk about a lot of criminal sentencing issues and defining crime or upping the penalty for bad behavior, one of the issues we have to continually ask is the plea bargaining process, and both the cost of prosecution and what that does to the effect of victims. Is that a concern that you see coming your way? Do you have any way of responding to that?
Yeah, there is, I think, an umbrella issue that actually stretches across both the criminal and civil division that relates to that. There are several factors. One of the thing is basically resources, as with probably every agency that you deal with. The more people that you have, the more you can focus on things and avoid having to try to figure out ways to stretch your resources to address the problems before you. If you have more resources, you could have more people, ideally. And what do you do is you're basically having to make choices with what you have as to what you can pursue. Two days ago at the Senate, there was a question that was on particularly sex abuse cases. And, you can look at the statistics across the state, and over the last 10-year period, there's actually apparently a decline in sex abuse. But that doesn't reflect the regionalization of where there may be quite a different trend, and especially in the outlying areas. The percentage of conviction, if you take out the last 2 years, which apparently include cases that are not yet resolved, so they don't have full numbers, is pretty much over that 10-year period about the same. Could those statistics be altered by more resources and more personnel? Probably. You have on top of that a geographical condition, and that is basically related to the remote offices, which I haven't been to yet, historically a retention problem just recruiting people to go out there. There's a high turnover. Lay on top of that, in both the civil and criminal side, the salary structure for attorneys for the state is not keeping up with, for example, municipalities and boroughs in the state. There's getting to be a noticeable lag. So while we get people who are willing to be in entry-level positions, there's a statistical drop in the number of mid-level people who are willing to hang around, who are really quite important for mentoring and giving the knowledge base some kind of stability. Add to that the long-term employees approaching retirement under the old Tier 1 system. In the next few years, both sides of the law department and even of the administrative side are going to be losing the senior members of our staffs who have the knowledge and expertise that makes what you're talking about more effective. And absent more resources, it's going to be harder to imagine how you adequately sustain prosecution or service on the civil side as well as it has been. Could it be better? Sure, but it could get worse.
Mr. Chairman, one of the concerns I have is certainly, as your role as a consumer advocate here you have kind of a position as a victim's advocate. And we have many people who have crimes against them, both property crimes and crimes against themselves, who never seem to get satisfied. And so if you see those critical shortage areas that may be regional, certainly our budget process, but there might be other barriers, and so certainly I'm interested in hearing what some of those are. But one of the other concerns I have is that our resource at the prosecution level is maybe so slim, as you say, but we don't even handle misdemeanor cases in many places of the state. So there's a kind of a attitude of lawlessness that can prevail, because there's, so on your position on the Rural Justice Commission, we've looked at a couple of different resources. What are some of the things that have jumped out at you and said, this is a good fit?
I'm glad you brought it up through the chair, Representative Coghill. Is the Rural Justice Commission also has been trying to create some uniformity for village police officers, tribal police officers, and state law enforcement, to create some uniformity, because what you've pointed out is the absence of prosecution of the smaller crimes is often the beginning of more serious things. And when things aren't nipped in the bud early enough, they tend to become worse. So when finally it does draw the attention of the proper authorities, there's a serious problem there. And in very remote locations where there may be an absence of law enforcement, it is a problem. And again, there's a resource issue. Once there is some consensus about standards and how to train people for these places, the question then is, how do you pay for it? Are they entitled to pay? If you have standardized training, are they entitled to standardized compensation? And how can it be justified when the population base for a very tiny population, because it's by itself, may need some law enforcement, but you have in an urban area one person covering many, many more people. But without any enforcement, what happens when someone can get away with a minor crime because there's just not the ability to pay attention until they do something very bad?
If I'd like to follow on that, and then Representative Grunberg and then Representative Olson. One of the books that I've been reading over the last couple of months, because I'm a slow reader, is The Tipping Point. Fantastic book. And one of the things they talked about was New York City and Mayor Giuliani's approach, and he called it the broken window syndrome, or the broken window. And we just were touching on it, which is why I want to interrupt before your question, Representative Grunberg. And that is this notion that if you don't take care of broken windows and you don't take care of graffiti, then things worsen, which is just what Representative Coghill was talking about, with misdemeanors that go unprosecuted and the extensive plea bargaining that we're seeing in the coming out of the Department of Law. I'd like for you to respond to that, and then I'm going to defer to Representative Grunberg and Representative Olson, but then I'm going to come back to you after that, General. And I'd like for you to, notwithstanding your desire to understand your department better, I really have not heard this afternoon you articulate a vision of what you intend to execute as the Attorney General for the state of Alaska. So my question is about the broken window issue, and then I'll defer to my colleagues, and then I'd like to have you come back and answer that for me, and then Rep. Samuels has some questions after that. So if you address the broken window concept with me, please, about what your intent is there.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a pretty universal concept, which in my practice has a lot to do with what I mentioned early on, is that people are reluctant to hire lawyers to solve problems, and often by delaying things, the problems get worse, whereas if they had been willing to invest a little bit early on, it would have perhaps avoided greater cost later on. And in regard to the overall vision, what my goal, my focus, my desire to focus on would be the urban-rural divide in Alaska, and to try to reach a comprehensive solution to it, and to try to fulfill the idea that at some point all Alaskans, urban and rural, would see it as their state, not them versus us, not, you know, enclaves that see each other as being hostile to each other. And I think that it is a problem that perhaps has gotten worse in recent times. Living in a village for 2 years, I never really sensed it in the 1960s, but I have had opportunities to be in places on very brief trips since then in recent years, and it's there more, and perhaps that's more of an adult sensitivity to things, but I think that that would be my goal for a vision for what I would be trying to focus on as an attorney general, that would be that issue.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask three areas, please. You alluded to the problems you have in hiring and retaining good attorneys. A couple of years ago, we passed Senate Bill 141. How has that affected your ability to hire and retain?
I apologize for not being familiar with a bill by number. What
that's the new Tier 4 retirement bill.
I would say that is possibly going to be more and more of an issue over time. It's not where I have run across the issue just in the short time isn't especially noticeable in the specialized areas of attorneys where there are oil and gas, for example. We have just in the last couple of weeks had a person who just had a tremendous offer to move into a specialized area of law out of our department. We just could not compete on our salary schedule. What essentially that means is we've trained a specialist for someone else and we can't afford to keep what we've trained. On a similar note, in the same department, we had a support staff person who left for a private law firm, and her departing note to us was that she was now able to make literally $1,600 a month more doing basically the same thing for the firm. And in fact, support staff may have a higher turnover in our department than even the attorneys at this point, based on information I'm getting. So.
Through the chair.
But is Tier 4 itself, I don't see evidence that I could point to that changing that as something I could measure at this point in time.
So. Yeah, it only became effective last July.
Right.
But
now that you've clarified what it is, I know what it is, and that's I know what it is now that you told me what the bill is. But,
yeah. As the legislature considered this bill over the last several years and its effects, we were told that people would it'd be more difficult to attract good people to the classified service because one of the things that has attracted people to state service has been the retirement benefits. The salaries were lower, but the retirement package was very good. And secondly, as people received job offers and offers from other places, they'd be able to take their defined contribution benefits in a package and go and leave. They weren't tied to the state of Alaska for a defined benefits package, which really kept them here, but they'd be able to go elsewhere. And that's something at least this representative will be interested in pursuing over time. I think that you may find that this becomes more apparent with the higher paid professional state employees like lawyers than other employees, particularly because private firms offer a lot of money to lawyers and paralegals, and the attraction to draw them away once you've trained them is going to become ever more increasing. So I think that's something that you and your successors ought to keep close tabs on and let the legislature know what the effect over time is on your department of that It's not an answer I need now. I'd just like you to be alert on that.
Through the chair to Representative Grunberg, like I say, I have no reason to know what the impact of Tier 4 is at this time, but I do have the impression that the level of salaries and their state of competitiveness has been an issue even before that legislation may have kicked in.
So. Before getting to my other two lines, I'd like to pursue that a bit. Are you finding that the problems of retaining people are getting worse because the salary discrepancy between state salaries and private salaries is so great for lawyers and paralegals? It's getting to be more and more of a problem.
What I've been trying to put together is statistics, not for this meeting, but just in that question in general. And the comparison to private lawyers is really hard to quantify because there's such a variety there. But what is easier to measure and what I think is more appropriate to rely on at this point at least is just, for example, municipal or borough attorneys. And what appears to be the case is that if you compare 3-, 5-, and 10-year attorneys, at least at 3- and 5-year level, there's about a $10,000 lag on attorneys compared to how we pay boroughs roughly in this state. And so that's somewhat comparable, somewhat certain set of numbers. The 10-year level tends to get really skewed between places, and it's hard to know how to compare it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Since we have two other people waiting in line, I would ask that you have the representative be a little more concise. I can see the moment's ticking away. So.
Oh, okay. And we're going to have you coming back. So,
we're delighted about that.
Yeah. I was talking just a couple of days ago with one of the justices on the Supreme Court who was saying that now clerks who used to be staying in Alaska are going outside for that same reason. Secondly, we've heard in this committee and on some of the finance subcommittees about the problems in prosecutorial discretion in certain DA offices around the state. Some DAs are taking cases that normally they wouldn't, that don't have a good chance of success. And I've talked with Ms. Henry about this, and I'd like to either now or at the next time we see you know what's being done about that problem. That's my second question. And third, I'd like to chat with you a bit about the effect and help to the legislature of indeterminate fiscal notes. If we get an indeterminate fiscal note, we really can't tell what the effect is going to be on a department, and we get a lot of these on new criminal laws coming from your department.
That's a really great question.
So, I mean, you know, I'd just like you to be prepared to address these when we have a little more time. I don't want to take my colleagues' time now, but
just I'm perfectly willing to keep on staying here if you want.
Oh, do you want to continue, Mr. Chair? Then they could answer the question.
My preference would be to be done.
So. I have 3 o'clock also. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
So we appreciate your generosity. But okay. The nice thing about having you back, yeah, in the General, not to interrupt Representative Grunberg, but the nice thing about when bills are held over, when you thought all your questions were resolved on Monday, by the time you take the bill up on Wednesday, everybody thought of a second round of questions. So we are delighted about having the opportunity to get to know you better. You are terrific, just terrific. I want you to know I think more highly of you now than I did at 1 o'clock, and I had an extraordinarily high opinion of you at 5 minutes to 1. So,
which you're out of the room for a few minutes, though.
Well, I was. I was. Thank you, Representative Lynn. Anyway, if you'd like
I'll yield to Representative Olson.
Yeah, Representative Olson.
Oh, thanks, Chairman Rammers. Approximately how many employees are you responsible for? 1,200, 1,500?
About 540.
540?
Roughly.
How many of those are exempt positions?
I believe all 280 attorneys are exempt.
How many terminations at will have you had since you've held this job?
One termination at will, and one was offered another position.
The termination at will was your first or second day on the job?
Roughly.
It was highly visible. without getting into the, you know, the specifics of it, your background is on the civil side. That was on the in the criminal division.
That's right.
Was that your decision, or was it based on the advice of other people or somebody else?
I ultimately am responsible for the decision. I did definitely had input from people.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Representative Samuels?
Thank you. Subsistence, gaming, criminal justice, you got 9 minutes. I'll stick to the criminal questions for right now. Okay. Save the others for later.
And I'll add, I have a great deal of interest in the gaming issues as well and some of the subsistence issues. We really do have material things that we want to come back and speak to you on next week. And Representative Lynn has a question. Representative Samuels?
First of all, just a general question, more of a get-to-know-you philosophical question. Do you think we have an activist Supreme Court in Alaska? Do you think that they sometimes overreach their bounds?
You know, a variation of this question came up in the Senate, and I think it's important that I try to do my best to show I respect the court and not try to categorize with a broad brush what they may be perceived at a given time. I have a high level respect for the court and the system we have, and I think it just would be wrong for me to try to categorize them one way or the other.
Fair enough answer. And sticking with the court system, and I'll get to the criminal next go around. Judicial counsel, do you think that you commented earlier when the question came up on electing an AG
mm-hmm.
or having appointed AG? And you commented briefly on just a very brief answer. Do you think that we have a better system now than if we elected judges? And secondly, do you think that the Judicial Council could use any reforms in the way that we select our judges? If you agree with the system of that we have right there, using the Judicial Council and using appointed judges rather than elected, do you see any changes that could be made there to make it a better system?
Yeah, I guess I view the system as working. I didn't come into this position or ever have a desire to reform how we select judges. If you were to ask me, you know, do I see anything that I feel it may be an issue about the Judicial Council itself, what I would note is that the attorney members are elected by the bar. And the bar is basically a voluntary voting, and it is pretty clear that there isn't as high a percentage of voting as the bar would like. Sometimes they send out the ballot more than once to try to get people to participate. And so I guess that raises a question about is the composition of the Judicial Council being skewed by a low bar participation in the selection of the members they contribute? And how is that related to giving a proper cross-section of the bar itself? I don't know. I don't know that anyone's ever studied who is voting in the bar and are they different from those who don't vote. But it is a crucial component of a composition of a group that really is kind of a gatekeeper into who gets presented to a governor. And I think the statute says they have to present at least two candidates. And, if there are 10 candidates and only two go forward, to what degree is that a result of people screening things more than maybe they should, and that shouldn't the governor may have more say about the options they have? And I know we've had a couple historical situations where governors have demanded different names or a different number of candidates, but that part would be in the control of the legislature. You could say they must present at least four names if four people apply. Would that change things dramatically? Would improve it? It might. I mean, more choices, I think, in general works out to give people more options, which generally options are better than not having them.
Do you know, can state lawyers serve as an attorney?
As an attorney?
If they're a member of the Bar Association and they work, I mean, can Marion Henry serve? And she's nodding no that she cannot, but I don't know the answer.
it to?
I don't know the answer for sure on that. If she's nodding, that's probably the case, because that would indicate she's looked into it, which again would skew it further as to who's available to screen people at that level.
Okay, and then when it comes to conduct of a judge, would it be an ethical violation? They've got their commission on judicial conduct that they'd take over. If it went to a criminal action, that would proceed through the process as normal. If the judge had potential criminal action, then it would come to the Attorney General's office to prosecute. Is that a fair assessment?
I don't know for sure if that's the case. My guess is it would, if there's a criminal prosecution, it would have to come through the Attorney General's office.
But, I assume that's true, too. Okay, I'll let you go, Mr. Chairman.
For housekeeping measures, General, we have time available the week after next, so we will, Jane will check with your schedule to see if that's convenient for you. Representative Lynn has a question in a moment, and then after that, just before we go, so that you get a sense of the questions that are remaining around the table, I might have us just comment on the subject matters that we feel yet have not been covered, so you'll have a better sense of what issues we'd like to have you back to continue to learn from you where you are philosophically on these issues. So with that, Representative Lynn?
Well, a very simple question compared to the other, not very philosophical at all. I see you're enrolled in the Northern Studies for your PhD program, which you hope to get next year, 9 thesis credits left. What is the nature, what courses are you taking for that? Does that relate to your present job or personal interest? What courses are you involved in there?
All the coursework is done. All the comprehensive work is done. All that's left is the dissertation, and that's partly done. What courses I've taken are comparative histories of northern cultures, circumpolar health, history of Alaska, history of Quebec, things that relate to northern studies and territorial histories of Alaska. And so the Northern Studies program relates to northern topics, and these are focused in the historical side.
I think obviously pertains to your job now. Thank you.
You're welcome, Representative Lynn. So if we can just go around the table so that the general have a sense of what issues we still have concerns about. Representative Grunberg, just broad brush strokes.
Yeah, I've asked two, aside from the things I asked for written responses on. I'll be asking you to follow up a little bit to discuss the prosecutorial discretion issues that have arisen in several districts here. And Ms. Henry can fill you in a bit on that. Secondly, to talk a little bit about what your policy is going to be on fiscal notes on bills and filling in some figures as opposed to just indeterminate fiscal notes. And I may have other issues too, but those should be pretty quick.
Thank you, Representative Coghill.
Probably three issues, and one of them already brought up, and I'm really interested in Alaska petitioning the authorities to be on what tribal status really means in Alaska. The other issue is probably a little lighter, and that is the role of consumer protection in Alaska, how you see that, what's going on in the Department of Law, if you expect to manage it any differently, what your resource base is. And then the other thing is I've been involved in a civics education process with the department, with the Judicial Council, Judicial Council, but I think the Department of Law is involved in it. I would suggest you ask about the Department of Law's participation in teaching youngsters about a process of law, and if not, I'd like to talk to you about it.
Thank you, Representative Coghill. Representative Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll like to know your feelings on subsistence in McDowell and that kind of broad area. Questions there on gaming, going back to some of the questions that Representative Coghill asked earlier. If it's a week, I'll probably have some more questions on oil and gas. And then I had just a series of questions, some procedural questions on criminal justice questions, probably similar to what the Senate asked you on sex offender rates and some procedural things for you on crime. So those four.
Representative Lynn?
And you skipped over me, but we're all involved in ethics legislation. State Affairs Committee now, it's going to be before this committee, hopefully soon. And if you just overview on data that pertains to your office, any guidance on some of the questions we may have on that, since this committee is going to be looking at that very carefully.
Thank you. And and for myself, I'm interested in the Endangered Species Act, how that's going to affect exploration for oil and gas. I'm interested in some problems we've had, particularly in Fairbanks, with the DOT on the Alaska Procurement Code, which has cost the state an enormous amount of money in trying to cure some of those issues. DUIs, misconduct involving a controlled substance in the sixth degree, and some of the outcomes of the methawana legislation that we passed last year, some of the outstanding lawsuits that have been filed by the ACLU. I'm interested in the state's relationship, or the Department of Law's relationship, with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And then I have some questions about gaming also, and gaming as it relates to the initiative process and the Department of Law's role in validating initiative questions. So we really have quite a lot of meat that we're interested in. And I will reiterate as we wind things up, General, we're delighted to have you before us. And I, as my dear friend Representative Stoltz said, you are perhaps the most unsnobbish intellectual that we might all meet, and so I'm just delighted to be able to keep you at our House Judiciary party so that we might have an opportunity to better meet and know you on behalf of our committee, our body, and those folks that are watching gavel to gavel. And we're thrilled. We're glad to be able to take our time. We thank you for your availability and your specificity. And your approach, which is really quite refreshing. You will be my fourth attorney general in 2.25 years, I think. Renke's, Nordstrand, Marquez. So it's important to know our AG. Sorry. Yes, right. So anyway, it's a pleasure to have you before us. We'll look forward to seeing you again. And
that doesn't beat the record of the Speaker of the House. Two, 3 in 2 days.
So with that, we're adjourned to 3:05. Thank you.